Good evening. This is the Thursday night edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas will join me in just a couple of minutes for this edition. I do want to remind you that even though the phone volunteers have gone home for the evening, they'll be back tomorrow morning, it is still very much possible for you to participate in this spring fundraiser, KUAF. It's the spring fundraising week. This is the time when we take just a couple of minutes to remind you that the reason we can bring you the stories we bring you on Ozarks at Large is because of your continued financial support. You can pledge online right now and all through the night. Wake up at 2 a.m., you can still pledge online at supportkuaf.com. We let you determine the amount. We let you determine the time and the method. All of those decisions up to you. When you contribute, how much you contribute, and how you contribute. But we do want to remind you that programs like Fresh Air that you just heard, NPR News on the Hour that you just heard, Performance Today that's coming up later, all these programs come with a price tag. And we are able to pay for the programs with financial contributions from you and listeners like you. More than 60% of our operating budget comes directly from listeners. About 90% of our budget is created locally. 60%, more than 60%, comes directly from listeners like you. And we think that's great. The majority of our budget comes from the people who use and listen to KUAF. If you haven't contributed yet and you've been meaning to do so, you can do it right now online at supportkuaf.com. Ahead on tonight's edition of Ozarks at Large, an update from the oil spill in Mayflower, and the jugglers are coming. We're going to have jugglers in Fayetteville, in Eureka Springs, Springdale, and Fayetteville over the next week or so. Those stories and much more ahead on tonight's edition of Ozarks at Large.
But first, the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration has allayed Governor Mike Beebe's initial concerns about the recent pipeline rupture and oil spill in Mayflower. Yesterday, the governor spoke with Cynthia Quarterman, head of the agency which operates under the Department of Transportation. Matt DeCampbell, the governor's spokesman, says the agency answered a number of the governor's questions concerning the pipeline's history and how the cleanup effort will continue. He says the agency will be working toward answering some fundamental questions about the pipeline.
Once they reach it, it has to pass a number of tests before the pipeline can be restarted, and it's probably going to be some time before that occurs, both to determine what happened and to determine that it's replaced and safe before it can be started again.
DeCampbell says ExxonMobil will most likely continue to cooperate in investigations of the accident. He says regular pipeline operations will stay off until the oil company addresses the many questions public officials have.
As a state investigation gets underway looking at the oil spill in Mayflower, Attorney General Dustin McDaniel toured the site yesterday where the pipeline ruptured. He says it left him with more questions than answers. He also told reporters he's bothered by how ExxonMobil, which owns the 65-year-old pipeline, has minimized the accident.
I have been reminded by Exxon's representatives that this is a relatively small spill and cleanup is going just great. I hope that they realize that to the homeowners in this area, it is not small, it is catastrophic. And for those who fear for their drinking water, things are not great.
McDaniel also said this highlights the need for improvements in pipeline maintenance, inspections, and safety standards. We'll have more on this story coming up on Ozarks.
An Arkansas House committee passed a proposal yesterday to offer $125 million to a steel company to locate in the state. The House Agriculture and Economic Development Commission advanced on a voice vote a bill that would give the state the authority to use state money for economic development to provide infrastructure, training, and tax credits for Big River Steel, which would be located in Osceola. State Economic Development Director Grant Tenniel told lawmakers the plan isn't without risk, but whether it fails or not would be an economic benefit to the state.
There is risk in this project. There is risk in every endeavor we undertake, I suppose. Getting out of bed in the morning carries risk. We have done our best to understand exactly where the risk is and to mitigate it as best we can.
Sam Camilla of Nucor Steel, which is already located in Mississippi County, says state involvement in the Big River project would drive down prices and cost existing steel jobs.
We don't believe putting public funds in this project is a good investment for the state or its taxpayers. As we've said, if forced to, we will win this competition. It's our great workforce that will carry the day, not the reckless promise of phantom jobs in a struggling economy. But winning this competition will not happen without high, senseless costs to both Nucor, Big River Steel, and to the taxpayers of Arkansas.
Proponents insist the steel mill is a good opportunity for the state. The bill now heads to the House, where it will need a simple majority to pass. Additional bills to appropriate money needed for the project will take a 75% majority.
The forecast calls for chilly weather tonight for the Northwest Arkansas Natural season opener against the Midland, Texas Rockhounds. Partly cloudy with lows from 33 in Northwest Arkansas to 40 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, a return to spring weather with sunny skies and highs from the upper 60s to around 70 degrees in Fort Smith. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with lows in the upper 40s.
This is Ozarks at Large. As the cleanup of an oil spill continues, Arkansas's Attorney General says it highlights the need for stricter pipeline standards. Yesterday, Dustin McDaniel toured the Mayflower neighborhood where a pipeline ruptured last week. Michael Hiblin from our content partner KUAR was there.
Attorney General Dustin McDaniel and investigators from his office met with emergency officials and oil company representatives to walk through the residential area.
That neighborhood was like a scene from The Walking Dead. There were still Easter decorations on homes, but there was not a soul in sight other than people in hazmat suits.
The 22 homes there have been evacuated since Friday when the Pegasus pipeline ruptured, spewing thousands of barrels worth of heavy crude onto lawns and roadways.
I have seen the source of the leak, and I came away with more questions than answers. How long was it leaking? How deep beneath the surface is the plume? What caused the rupture? And many other questions.
Tuesday night, McDaniel issued a subpoena for all records from pipeline owner ExxonMobil related to the spill, as his office looks into its cause and impact.
I let it be known that I was coming today with lawyers and with investigators, and we were coming on behalf of the state. And many times they attempted to route me into a van and take me on a tour. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not here for a tour, and I'm not getting into a van. We are here on behalf of the state of Arkansas as the state's lawyer, as a constitutional officer empowered by the General Assembly to enforce our laws. And we were here to conduct an investigation, not take a tour. So I didn't appreciate some of how we were treated, so I can only imagine how some of the homeowners must have felt.
About 600 workers have been brought into Mayflower to clean up the oil, with heavy equipment in place throughout the town. Earlier in the day, Republican Congressman Tim Griffin also came to the accident site and believes the company is making good progress.
From talking to the president of the pipeline, the pipeline part of Exxon, I believe that they are here to fix this. I'm sure that they would rather not have this happen. And they're here to fix it. And as Alan Dotson and all of us made clear, if we ever get the sense that they're not here for that reason, then we're gonna fix it. We're gonna make sure that they are. But they've been very cooperative.
ExxonMobil has apologized for the accident and says it will pay for the cleanup and all damage caused. Griffin says using pipelines is the safest way to transport oil and has maintained his support for building the proposed Keystone Pipeline, which is under consideration in Washington.
There have been some national comments on Facebook in particular. I think there's a little national campaign going on to try to turn this into something about Keystone, but haven't really heard much from constituents.
But Attorney General McDaniel says this shows the need for an increase in standards in regulating pipelines.
I've been told repeatedly that Exxon was up to date on their inspections and that their inspections showed no cause for concern. But we have a pipeline that's 65 years old that ruptured in someone's yard, so either the inspections were not adequate or there was something that was completely beyond the ability to identify within inspection, which I find very unlikely, which means we need to be very thoughtful about how we're inspecting America's aging subterranean energy transportation infrastructure.
In Mayflower, I'm Michael Heplin.
On this week's Generic Blue Show, we have a fundraising edition, new music from Cena Earhart, Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale, the Cashbox Kings. I even brought in fable legend Wally Matthews. That's this Friday night at 9 o'clock, the Generic Blue Show. We'll see you then.
John Kettner is a professor of archaeology for the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico. In February, he spoke on the University of Arkansas campus as part of the Stigler Lecture Series. I spoke with him while he was here. His talk, Chaco Canyon, From the Outside Looking In, focuses on an area in northwestern New Mexico, what we call the Four Corners, where Colorado, Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico meet. It's a canyon, but it is also an area of ruins. In the center of Chaco Canyon, there is a mass of monumental architecture from 1,000 years ago. Dr. Kettner says that what is so amazing about Chaco Canyon is that this location is literally in the middle of nowhere, a very arid environment, cold, windy, and little water. He looks at why and how, over 1,000 years ago, this monumental center rose in the middle of the desert. I began by asking him what he means by, from the outside, looking in.
The general consensus about Chaco Canyon is that it was a ceremonial center, perhaps a pilgrimage center, and people came from many, many miles around and brought things like corn and timbers and pots. They even imported things like chocolate and macaws from Mesoamerica, copper bells, turquoise. Anything that was of value from many, many miles around came into the canyon. And so when we say from the outside looking in, not only is it us looking at it today, but it's also thinking about how people back then who were living in small farming villages scattered all over the area, what is it about the canyon that they found so compelling that they were interested in bringing in their best resources into this really desolate area? So,
and then it was sort of a trading post, or?
Yeah, although what we now understand about the canyon is that all this stuff went into the canyon and nothing ever came out. So it wasn't so much a trading post, but it was a consumer, an ultimate consumer. We can find, if we take a look, for example, at the trash piles that are in the canyon, you can see huge deposits of things like broken pottery and the remains of huge feasts and the like that were deposited there. So everything was coming into the canyon and it was staying there. So it wasn't really being traded out.
It was being used for, I think you mentioned that they were having the kind of ceremonies and,
right.
and things. Right.
Exactly. So okay. They had probably these events, ceremonial events that were likely tied to celestial phenomena such as solstices and equinoxes. Farming societies all around the world pay close attention to what's happening in the sky because it helps to guide them in their farming activities. And it's likely that during these major events, people came in from dozens and dozens of miles around, and they brought in food and offerings to the ceremonial center, and then as part of that, they would have these large feasts, various other kinds of events that they would all partake in.
Well, so you mentioned that, people that were scattered about, farmers and whatnot, kept coming into the center. Who built this center? Who was organizing it?
That's a great question. That's one of the that's one of those questions which has been debated quite a bit. One of the more popular theories over the years is that there were these very powerful leaders, perhaps powerful priests, that resided in the center, and they helped to guide what happened there. And one idea is that people who came in on these pilgrimages, part of fulfilling their ceremonial obligations would have been actually contributing their labor as well as their resources towards the center. So people would come in. One important note about the canyon is there are no trees in the canyon, but there's all these buildings. So all the timbers, it's estimated at perhaps 200,000 timbers had to be hand-carried across the desert. There were no beasts of burden, and so people are bringing in these timbers to roof the buildings and then perhaps contributing their labor to building the masonry work, to plastering the buildings, to repairing the buildings, as well as any other numbers of things. So that's one thought, is that there was these very powerful priestly leaders that were in charge and were giving instructions about how to...
for kind of a higher purpose.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The idea there is that people felt compelled to contribute their labor and resources because they thought perhaps that that would help them in their farming success. So that's one idea about the canyon. The other is that this was a purely cooperative endeavor, something which is sort of interesting to think about in our day and age, and that people actually, without the presence of leaders, came together and cooperated in the construction of the center because they felt that it was towards a higher good, towards a common good that would benefit them all, and that there wasn't a strong coordinated leadership.
Earlier on, you mentioned, for astrological purposes, I guess. And when I was looking at it, when I was looking up information about it, I saw that it was kind of built, you know, maybe with the sun in mind.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the more impressive aspects of Chaco Canyon, is that certainly as time went on, and it lasted, you know, perhaps a few generations at its height. But during that height, which took place in the 11th century A.D., the entire landscape within the canyon was constructed in order to align with various important directions and solar phenomena. So, for example, a lot of the buildings are oriented in cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. Most of the buildings seem also to have had built within them these features for observing important solar phenomena, like the solstices and the equinoxes. So, for example, you might have during an equinox, the sun passed through a window and hit a niche in the opposite wall from the window, and it only happens on that day. And then there's the famous what's called the sun dagger, which is this really well-known and very impressive feature that was built on top of a mesa in the canyon. And it's an alignment of stones that are arranged in such a way that the light will pass through them, hit rock art on the wall opposite of them, and according to where the dagger of light falls as it passes through those rocks, it actually is predicting which equinox or which solstice is actually taking place. This would have been an amazing feature to produce, because it's actually one feature that's predicting multiple kinds of solar phenomenon. So that's something which would have been very difficult for societies anywhere to have been able to do.
Well, that's why I was going to ask, how did they do this? I mean, because they didn't have really, you know, I mean, the tools and, I mean...
Sure, yeah, it's very impressive. And there's even some suspicion that same solar marker, this so-called sun dagger, may have also been used to predict lunar phenomena. So that's even more difficult to have all that coordinated in mm-hmm. one single observation point.
Have you had to study astronomy
a little bit
as an archaeologist?
Yes, yeah, the beauty of archaeology is that you get to dabble in lots of things, and certainly astronomy is one of those. So
I guess I get to dabble in a lot of things too, like archaeology, and then this afternoon I'm interviewing somebody about art, and which is similar,
great.
I guess, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Archaeology,
it's fun,
similar, huh? Yeah. One of my questions was, you know, well, what happened to these people?
Yeah, so this phenomenon, as I've described it, because we don't exactly know how to characterize it, so we use the word phenomenon a lot to refer to Chaco. Its height is around the late 1050s AD, and by the early 1100s, the canyon is essentially empty. People have no longer... they're no longer doing their pilgrimages to the center, and although over the ensuing centuries people continue to pass through the canyon, they no longer use it as such an impressive place. But people continue to exist in the larger Southwest. So the folks who had lived in Chaco Canyon, they moved elsewhere.
Where else do your studies take you?
Well, that's a good question. I've recently been doing some work in collaboration with some archaeologists who do their excavations in Peru. There is, on the south coast of Peru, a center known as Kawachi, and most people are familiar with it because the folks that lived at Kawachi built the Nazca Lines, and the Nazca Lines are sort of those famous lines that can be observed from the sky, and there's a lot of shapes of, like, hummingbird shapes, and there's a monkey shape, for a while, people proposed that perhaps even aliens had been responsible for creating these lines. So it's the Nazca lines are known to a lot of people. What's interesting about comparing Kawachi with Chaco Canyon is that they're both these major pilgrimage centers. They both built these alignments in the ground. So in Chaco Canyon, as I mentioned, they built these long roadways, and in Kawachi, they built the Nazca lines. People came to both Kawachi and Chaco Canyon from many miles around.
Is this around the same time period also?
Actually, Kawachi's quite a bit earlier.
Okay.
But it's a very similar phenomenon. So my colleague who's at Purdue University, Kevin Vaughn, and I have been looking at these two centers and trying to figure out if by comparing Chaco and Kawachi, we can get a better understanding of how these kinds of pilgrimage centers or religious centers emerge in the first place.
Well, so Chaco Canyon is now it's a national park, nationally protected place.
Right.
How does one go about preserving what is there?
Well, that's always a challenge in the Southwest as well as in the south coast of Peru or most parts of the world. There's a pretty illegal and rich trade in antiquities, and because so many of these sites are in desolate areas, it makes them easy targets for what we call pot hunters, people who are excavating these sites and digging them up and taking materials out illegally. In the case of Chaco Canyon, that core area of the canyon is preserved by the National Park Service, and of course they closely monitor who gets access to it and all that. But outside of the protected area are dozens and dozens and dozens of sites, and those are not so well protected. That's a big concern as an archaeologist, because the destruction of those sites through illegal excavation means that when I'm trying to answer questions about what happened in this region, my ability to answer those questions is compromised by the destruction of these sites. So, for example, I've been working for a number of years a distance south of Chaco Canyon in one of the farming villages from whence the pilgrims came. And most of the households in the prehistoric community I've been working on were destroyed, have been badly damaged by people who were digging for pots. And a lot of these are folks that, you know, their families had always dug these sites up, and it was something that they did and didn't really think twice about, because it seemed like there's so many of these sites around. But it's a major issue for archaeologists because, as we say, if every single person who visited this area took something, then there'd be nothing left. So
why is it important to keep them? You know, why is it important for you to study them? Why is it important to keep them?
Sure, that's a great question. Well, for example, we know that again in the mid 1000s. Chaco Canyon was this huge center, a thriving center, thousands of people that were coming in and, again, importing things like chocolate all the way from what is now Mexico, or live macaws that they were trying to raise and bring in. You know, by any standard at that time, it seemed like there was no way that Chaco Canyon was ever going to end. But it did, and it ended, in some accounts, somewhat badly. In fact, the Pueblo people today still have stories about the demise of a place that probably is Chaco Canyon in their oral histories, and it was a pretty ugly end, a lot of violence. And
so what was this bubbling, vibrant place?
Right, so it ended, and so I think, you know, us today, it's useful and arguably very important to understand how these kinds of sort of pinnacles of a civilization, how it is that they end up falling apart. And in that case, it's probably a combination of the social and political structure that they had built up in the face of environmental change that challenged the ability of their social and political structure to contend with it. And I think these are lessons that are important for us to know today, because, of course, we we are sort of at a pinnacle of right. our civilization, and we know that there are climate changes taking place, whatever caused by, but we know that they're challenging us. And I think archaeologists can look back at all these societies that once thrived and then fell apart and use those lessons to contend with what we're facing today or in the future.
Have you always been interested in history and archaeology?
No, actually, I started out as an environmental biologist, and then I took an anthropology class and fell in love with it, and never really looked back. I still love environmental biology as well. A lot of my my work in archaeology is informed by mm-hmm. by those disciplines, and I have a real passion for archaeology. It's just, it can teach us so much about how humans behave on all, so many different levels.
Dr. James Kettner is a professor of archaeology at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He gave a talk, Chaco Canyon, From the Outside Looking In, in February on the University of Arkansas campus as part of the Stigler Lecture Series. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
It's about 28 minutes before 7 o'clock. This is Ozarks at Large for a Thursday evening, first Thursday in downtown Fayetteville. I'm Kyle Kellums. I'm be joined again by Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas in a few minutes. Many of the stories we're doing on Ozarks at Large this week, because it is our spring fundraiser, connect into the concept of the public radio fundraiser. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich was thinking about fundraisers. After all, she's done now 34 of them in her 17-year career here at KUAF, and she was wondering, why do they work, or do they work at all? So she called someone who's also familiar with the concept, public radio journalist Robert Krulwich. She asked him this: are public radio fundraisers a good thing?
I think they're a necessary thing. No, I don't think they're a good thing at all. No. I mean, people who listen to them year in, year out, think to themselves, well, there's something wrong with this scenario. Like they keep acting like they're about to sink under the sea. I never give them money, and yet they're back again a year later, and they do it again, and I still don't give them money, and there they are again. So someone is giving them money, and it doesn't have to be me. And I don't really believe them when they say that they're going to die without me, because they haven't died yet. So that's the dark part of it, I think, is that people who listen but don't give can do that pretty much forever, it seems.
Robert Krulwich pointed out that listeners who don't support public radio feed off the goodness of contributing listeners.
And so you're kind of a parasite on them a little bit. You're letting them do what you think you ought to do, but you don't do. So, and you don't feel great about it, but you try not to think about it too much. And that's why you turn off the pitches, because they remind you that you're not exactly God's greatest gift to humanity. So you look ugly in the mirror of it, so you turn off the mirror, basically.
Okay, so we need a whole new approach to this business of fundraising? Krulwich doesn't think so, because it's just human nature. Given the opportunity, we'll just take things, so we'll listen for free.
If you went to a store and you could try anything you liked in the store for free for as long as you liked, then I think you'd develop the odd habit of just taking. I think it's just perfectly normal. You just go in and say, I need Scotch tape. I'll just use a little bit of it, a little bit more. And when they consume the Scotch tape, but they're not asking you for money, so you haven't exactly stolen the Scotch tape. You've just borrowed it forever. And people will accommodate to that particular funny like morality. But I think people do need to be charged from time to time.
So basically, we have no choice. Fundraise, we must.
And it has to be demarcated, and it has to be, a little bit thrown in your face. Otherwise, you just wouldn't get around to it. Not because you're terrible or anything, just because you have other claims on you.
And even public radio science correspondent Robert Krulwich couldn't help himself. He started to pitch during our interview, illustrating that fundraising, for good or bad, is in the DNA of all NPR workers, even top-notch Peabody Award-winning ones.
You probably should pony up, because you've been listening to it on and off, and maybe a little bit more than before for the past year, and you like certain things, and it certainly takes, you know, it helps you pass the time in the car or cooking or whatever. So it's not like you have to. It's like you just ought to. You know, it's a decent thing to do.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
So there you have it. Robert Krulwich, who has been in journalism and radio for some time, says it's the decent thing to do. It is, and we appreciate everyone who has contributed so far in KUAF's history, and especially during this spring fundraising week. It is the spring fundraiser for KUAF, and though we do not have phone volunteers sitting by the phones right now, we do have the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week web option for you to pledge. That is supportkuaf.com. It's a simple process, and important to remember, we leave the amount and the method up to you. Some people like to become sustaining members where they give a little per month, which becomes a lot. You can get a lot from just a little. If you're a $15 a month sustaining member, that's $180 to KUAF over the course of a year. Sustaining members really do help prop up the station. All contributions help. We appreciate them all. You can contribute right now at supportkuaf.com. You can also, if you have the KUAF app that lets you listen to KUAF anywhere in the world on your smartphone, you can contribute that way as well. Just go to the KUAF app, and on that front page, you'll find the places that you can use to contribute. 1-800—I'm sorry, I was about to give you the phone number. It's too late to do that. You could do that tomorrow beginning at 6 a.m., but right now I'll give you the web address, and that again is supportkuaf.com. And from everyone here at Ozarks at Large and from everyone at KUAF and your fellow listeners, thank you very much.
For PT's young artist in residence, reading the notes on the page is not enough.
I was always trying to think about what is Brahms thinking. I always trying to discover things behind the black and white.
Our young artist in residence, violinist Xiang Yu, plays Brahms on Thursday's performance today from 8 p.m.
Performance today begins next on KUAF after this evening's Ozarks at Large at 8 o'clock. Busy, busy weekend coming up in just a few minutes. A conversation about all the jugglers that will be coming to Bentonville, Eureka Springs, Springdale, and Fayetteville over the next week. Bentonville High School students in the Cancer Challenge will host Laps for Life to help in the fight against cancer. That takes place Saturday from 6 until 10 p.m. at the Bentonville High School Track and Soccer Stadium. The third annual Laps for Life will benefit Teen Cancer Challenge and local cancer programs. Donations are 100% tax deductible. You can donate money or door prizes at 5835 West Sunset Avenue in Springdale. If you'd like more information, 273-3172. The Omni 350 Citizens Climate Lobby will meet Saturday from 11 a.m. until 1 in the afternoon at 3274 North Lee Avenue in Fayetteville. A potluck lunch will be included. More information about that available at 445-6567. And the Gravette Historical Museum will host its annual exhibit titled My Collection Saturday morning from 10 until Saturday afternoon at 2. Takes place on the grounds of the museum in Gravette. The special exhibit will feature the private collections of many Northwest Arkansas residents. This is a one-day-only affair on Saturday. Some collections featured arrowheads, cookbooks, stamps, vintage glassware and dishes, and more. If you'd like to know more about Saturday's event, cityofgravette-ar.gov. And to tell us more about what's happening over the course of the next few hours, here is Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. She is with Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas.
Thank you, Kyle. Becca Martin Brown is joining me now to tell us what's up tomorrow.
Well, it's actually what's up tonight.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Because tonight is opening night for the Fort Smith Little Theater production of Steel Magnolias.
I love this movie.
I
Julia
do,
Roberts.
Too. They've done an interesting in-between.
Okay.
The play does not include the men folk at all.
Okay.
Which I personally thought was fine. We'll get calls about that. The movie includes the men. They've decided that their version sort of includes the men. They're doing transitional vignettes, sort of silhouetted, that include the men like when Shelby gets married, when the baby is born, when Shelby dies. And the director, Summer Ferguson, tells me, you'll get to see Shelby one more time at the end.
All right.
Sounds interesting. 8 o'clock tonight at Fort Smith Little Theater, 401 North 6th Street. Tickets are $25 for tonight. The show continues this weekend, and all the other performances are $10. And tomorrow night is First Friday.
Rogers?
No. That would be in Bentonville.
Bentonville, sorry.
Street performers, jugglers, stilt walkers, fire eaters, magicians. Sure, why not? 11:30 to 1 p.m. and 5 to 8 p.m. And that's all happening on the square in downtown Bentonville.
Okay. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Kyle?
This is Ozarks at Large. Beginning tomorrow, there will be beanbags, tennis balls, machetes, and flaming torches hurtling through Northwest Arkansas. Street performers, including jugglers, are the main attraction at tomorrow's First Friday in downtown Bentonville. Saturday night, an event called Ozark Mountain Mystique includes jugglers from around the country, including world champions, at The Odd in downtown Eureka Springs. That begins Saturday night at 7. Friday and Saturday, April 12th and 13th, more than 100 jugglers of all skill levels will be tossing things about at the All-Star Sports Arena in Springdale. And on the evening of April 13th, the 2013 Northwest Arkansas Juggling Spectacular will begin at 7 at the Global Campus Theater on the Fayetteville Square. To help prepare for all of this tossing about, we present 15 things you should know about juggling. We enlisted four local jugglers and one world champion juggler to create our list. Number one, you can learn juggling from an unexpected source.
In fact, the first time I went to meet my wife's parents, I walked in the door and he was juggling three machetes. So there was a little bit of an intimidation factor there.
That's Galen Harp, a member of the Institute of Juggleology based in Fayetteville. He learned to juggle after that encounter with his future father-in-law when he was 26. That brings us to fact number two about juggling. After you learn how, you'll likely inspire others.
I was 8 years old when I first learned to juggle. I was at a concert and I met Galen. He was doing the Chinese Diablo. And he told us about the juggling club here in Rogers. And so we started coming to it, and I was learning the Diablo. And then my dad was just waiting around, so he learned how to juggle. But then I saw that, and I was like, oh, I should juggle.
Ethan Robison of Eureka Springs is already an accomplished juggler. He performed at the International Juggling Association show and won fourth place in the world in the juniors division. And Ethan gave us fact number three already. There is a juggling club in Northwest Arkansas that you can find out more about at the NWA Juggling Club Facebook page. Ethan's dad, by the way, Edward Robison, also juggles. Father and son travel together and learn together. And that brings us to juggling fact number four. Juggling parents and children possess a unique understanding.
Yeah, and I actually kind of got in trouble for letting him juggle fire at a party in Lawrence, Kansas. a juggler there we just met had fire, and he's like, is your son going to try? I said, sure. And then after I told my wife about it, she was like, he's nine. But he can juggle, you know, clubs and knives and everything just fine, and I figured, why not fire?
Yeah, there's really no difference between a juggling club and a torch, other than that there's fire.
Fact number five. Jugglers think there is little difference between something on fire and something not on fire. Which brings us to fact number six. Jugglers practice, practice, practice. Ellen Winters of Fayetteville, an organizer of the Juggling Spectacular in Fayetteville, says she didn't begin juggling torches or machetes until she could reliably toss and catch less lethal objects 100 times consistently. Fact number seven, Ellen says you can teach yourself.
I first started juggling when I was 11. My parents gave me a book for Easter that came with three beanbags. I think it's the best way to learn, short of having a juggling teacher. It's called the Juggling for the Complete Club.
And Ellen says, juggling fact number eight, you're never too old.
We teach juggling, and we have taught a 60-year-old couple to pass balls back and forth. So I would say that really there's not a limit.
No limits is an unofficial juggler's creed. Why not is another. Galen Harp, the juggling partner of Ellen Winters, says jugglers are only limited by their imagination, though, and here's fact number nine, juggling objects of different weights ups the difficulty.
And so it definitely changes it quite a bit. Like juggling a wadded-up paper ball and a regular juggling ball and a bowling ball is really difficult because every time you get the paper ball, you want to just launch it. And then when you get the bowling ball, after you've just thrown a paper ball, your senses just it's a constant readjusting of the pressures you're using in your hands.
Juggling fact 10. For some jugglers, the toss and catch is simply not enough. Ellen Winters says some of the world champions coming to Northwest Arkansas over the next few days have added much more to their repertoire.
We have another juggler named Chad Lunders, who's appeared on The Ellen Show, doing a demonstration of his world record of balancing on a rollabola on top of a picnic table while juggling machetes and reciting Hamlet.
I was able to recite Hamlet. I learned that in college.
Juggling fact number 11, world champion jugglers can be reached by phone and love to talk about their eye-popping abilities. This is Chad Lunders discussing how he came up with the idea of balancing on a board atop a 12-inch cylinder, sitting on a picnic table with machetes constantly in the air and asking to be or not to be.
And then I thought, okay, I can maybe say Hamlet really, the soliloquy really fast while juggling clubs. And then, of course, I said, no, not clubs. Machetes has to be the thing that's juggled with Hamlet's soliloquy. And then I thought, all right, then I'll put it on the rollabola. So I practiced that for the Kansas City Juggling Festival where they wanted me to do something. And then while I was practicing, there was a picnic table out back, and I thought, you know, they might be able to see me a little bit better if I stand up on that picnic table. So I was just getting ready to see if it was going to work when someone comes out with a video camera and says, we're ready. So I really didn't get a chance to practice. I just got up there on the picnic table, and first time, it all worked out.
And jugglers, at least through our informal survey, love to offer examples of their talents and don't mind being asked to show off a little at a party, campfire, or almost anywhere. That's juggling fact number 12.
And I think it just kind of goes with the territory. I kind of look at it as it's the juggler's version of an autograph. It's this one little thing that I can do to lighten the mood or make things a little happier than they were before.
And number 13, sometimes your juggling will catch the attention of somebody that doesn't quite appreciate your talent as much as the rest of us do. Many jugglers, on their journey from novice to experienced juggler, have been asked to leave a grocery store, you can figure out why, or another retailer. Again, Galen Harp of Fayetteville.
The sporting goods store, I think they drew the line at 5 tennis rackets.
But
I was honestly testing them out to buy.
But really, any...
Oh, as juggling material.
Yeah.
Not for a forehand.
But yeah.
Fact number 14. Jugglers say certain things very casually, certain things that nobody else would ever say at all. An example, Chad Lunder's answer when I asked him if he also, like some jugglers, rides unicycles or walks tight ropes or spins plates.
I do a little unicycling. I don't do very much plate spinning, but about every juggling prop that there is, I have probably picked up and tried, whether it be the Chinese Diablo, bouncing balls, spinning tops, all sorts of different props. So I've done a little bit of everything, you could say.
You know you're talking to a juggler when they say offhand, I haven't done much plate spinning. And fact number 15, your chances to see these jugglers and many others are numerous over the next week and a half. Many will be performing tomorrow at First Friday on the downtown Bentonville Square. Others will be at the Odd in downtown Eureka Springs Saturday night at 7. Still more jugglers will be at the All-Star Sports Arena in Springdale Friday night and Saturday afternoon, that's April 12th and 13th, and the 2013 Juggling Spectacular will be Saturday night, April 13th at 7 at the Global Campus Theater on the Fayetteville Square. We have a link to all of those events at ozarksatlarge.com. Oh, and here's a bonus fact. Number 16, juggling can be better than Cupid's arrow. Ellen Winter's husband learned how to juggle just to get a second date with her.
He was incredibly resourceful. He made his own juggling balls by putting pennies in socks, rolling them up, and wrapping them in duct tape. And he learned 4 balls that way.
This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, April 4th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Jody Beznoska, Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. How's it going?
It's
Pledge
good.
Week.
Yes, it's very busy here. But
you guys are all still in very good voice.
Yes. We are plugging away.
Yes. And we appreciate everyone who's helping us out.
Yeah.
You guys are not exactly slouches
the
street.
No, we're rocking away. Today's Thursday, right?
So I think so.
Yes. Tonight we have a concert with the University of Arkansas Inspirational Choir.
Yes.
Tomorrow the Lambda Chi Alpha sorority will be taking over and having their event. And then Saturday we have two performances of the Popovich Comedy Pet Theater. This is a Russian acrobat who trains he trains rescue pets of all kind of animal variety, geese, ducks, rabbits, cats, dogs. Really kind of fantastic, fun family show. Definitely a good one if you're looking for something to do on Saturday. There's a 10 o'clock and a 4 o'clock performance. So two shows on Saturday.
I heard he uses a lot of cats.
Yeah, he does.
How do you?
He's a cat person.
From my experience, cats do what they want to do. I'm curious.
Here's the secret. You make the cats think they want to do what you're having them do.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And that's 10 and 4 Saturday.
10 and 4 on Saturday.
Yes.
And then Anything Goes begins next week. The first show is Tuesday at 7, and then it runs all the way through Sunday. The final show will be Sunday at 2 p.m.
If you can go into this show and mm-hmm. then come out and you're not humming one of the tunes,
mm-hmm.
you may not even be a big fan of musical theater, but you're the top.
Delightful, lovely.
Anything goes.
Yes.
And it's cheerful.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I love about it. Like, it has been gray and raining for, 3 months straight, it feels like. And I promise you, this show will lift your spirits. It will just make you smile, and you will marvel at how awesome it is.
Well, it's classic Broadway. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah. And one of the things I love about Anything Goes, just as a general concept, is that the way it was created was there were all these great songs. And
they
wanted to put the music, they wanted to make a musical out of them. So
they weren't written for the stage specifically.
Exactly.
Cole Porter was writing
them
to be heard and played on pianos, and they said, hey, he's got a lot of them.
And then he wrote the story.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's why the story is sort of, it's a story, but the story plays second fiddle really to the music and the dancing. And sometimes you go, well, how did they decide to put these songs together? But it doesn't really matter because you're like, great, they're dancing and it's beautiful. And they just created it to find a way to showcase this fantastic music. And it's become the standard. You know, this thing has been around for 60, 70 years now. So wonderful. Oh, can't wait. So that's from the 9th through the 14th. And let's see, the University of Arkansas will do another spring choral concert on the 15th. They'll have a percussion ensemble concert on the 18th. That's preview night also for Next to Normal, their new show, Theater Squared's new show.
Which is so different,
mm-hmm.
but in a very good way from mm-hmm. Anything Goes.
Mm-hmm.
Here is
also a musical.
Also a musical,
yeah.
But whereas Anything Goes is, and I mean this in the best way, sort of frothy
mm-hmm.
and fun,
mm-hmm.
and the narrative isn't, while it's important, it's not as important as the music. The narrative in Next to Normal is highly integrated into the music. So two great musicals of different stripes.
You know, I'm looking at the calendar and I'm thinking about the next 2 months and I'm thinking about Broadway and I'm realizing that we have at Walton Arts Center, between our programming and between Theater Squared, we have four of what I would call the best new Broadway product that's come out in the last couple of years. One is a revival, which is Anything Goes. You have Next to Normal being done by T2. You have American Idiot.
Yes.
Yeah. And then later on in May, we have War Horse. And if you look at that lineup, I just realized this. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You have the chance to see probably the four most interesting Broadway shows that are out on the road and that really, they won all kinds of awards in New York. They are the acclaimed shows of our time. It's
Equity Productions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the real deal.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. So anyway, after that little rhapsody, so Next to Normal will continue for 3 weeks. It starts on the 18th and runs through there, through, I think, the 4th of May. We have our second Caravan Sarai performance on the 19th of April. This is the Orchestra of Fez.
Mm-hmm.
And Caravan Sarai is a partnership with the King Fahd Center at the university where we're exploring the music of Morocco. And then the Monterey Jazz Festival on tour is April 20th. And this is a group of highly respected and acclaimed jazz musicians. They're led by Christian McBride and Dee Dee Bridgewater.
Yeah.
And so those are some pretty
pretty big names in the jazz world.
It's in the big hole.
Yeah, and all kinds of things going on. American Idiot starts on the 26th of April and runs for just 4 performances. And if you are a university student or a high school student, we have student tickets for you for that show. So make sure you check that out. And then we will be into the first weekend of Artisphere. Can you believe it?
And at some point, we're going to have to talk about Artisphere.
Yeah.
Probably big time.
Because there's a big list of
things. We probably should. Yeah. At the very least, you should, if you're going to be traveling, try not to travel the first weekend of May. Because that's the Trail Mix concert tour weekend.
We'll talk about this more, I'm sure, but I've got the list of Artisphere in front of me. Mm-hmm. And there's something in May 18th. And all I have is the list, no description here. Mm-hmm. Grug. G-R-U-G.
What G-R-U-G.
No explanation. What is Grug?
Grug is a children's theater production. It is by an Australian puppet company. And Grug is actually this little creature. I think the best way
similar
to
similar to a slug?
No, he's not a slug. Mm. But that's a good. That's actually a really good. That I would. Why wouldn't you think that with the way the word sounds? He's more like a little haystack. And he has a face and a character, and he's a problem solver. He tackles problems in the world and tries to make solutions for them.
Perhaps the first problem solving haystack you've had at Walton Arts.
Yes, I don't think okay. we've ever had a problem solving okay. haystack before. But you just coined my favorite phrase of the day. That's right. Going to be fantastic.
Thanks. Oh, people want to know more about haystacks or anything?
Anything. You can visit waltonartscenter.org. You can call 443-5600. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook/Walton Arts Center. We're on Twitter, Walton_Arts. And we're also in person at the box office with a free gallery exhibition next door.
Thank you, Jody.
Thank you.
Jody Beznoska is Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Wesley. I'm Kyle Kellums, and just about all the time we have for Ozarks at Large tonight. Oh, wait, there is a chance for you to win one of 5 pairs of tickets to see the opening night performance of Anything Goes at Walton Arts Center. We asked this question first on the noon edition of our program, and we're going to ask it again. If you have an answer, you can email it to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. All correct answers go into the ceramic cow. We'll pull one out. Well, actually, we'll pull 5 out. 5 winners. Each winner will receive a pair of tickets to Tuesday night's opening night performance of Anything Goes, Great Cole Porter Music at Walton Arts Center. Okay, so again, the web address, ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. The question, this is the 195th anniversary of the U.S. Congress adopting the flag, the official flag of the United States. It had the 13 stripes, the red, white stripes that represent the colonies that we still have today. And there were enough stars on that flag in 1818 to represent all the states at the time. Now, of course, we have 50. How many did we have on that date in 1818? How many stars, how many states were in the Union in 1818 on this date, 195 years ago? If you have an answer, ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. All correct answers go in the ceramic cow. We will announce the winners. 5 different winners, a pair of tickets each. We will announce those winners for the Tuesday night performance on tomorrow's noon edition of Ozarks at Large. You'll be able to pick up your tickets at will call at Walton Arts Center Tuesday night. I did mention that, or if I haven't, I will now. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks to Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas for helping me out with this evening edition. All 3 of us will be back tomorrow at noon for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. It's still the spring fundraiser at KUAF, and you can still contribute online. It's an easy web address to remember. It is supportkuaf.com. It takes no more than 2 minutes. And if you pledge, mention that you were listening to the evening edition of Ozarks at Large. We do appreciate it. Performance today is up next. If you prefer to talk to someone when you make your pledge, you can do that again tomorrow morning beginning at 6. We'll have phone volunteers here for that. That number, 800-522-5832. But you can do it right now at supportkuaf.com.